standing in a tunnel, a lit tunnel, but only lit around the floor. There's an elevator at the end taking you to the top of the mountain we're in, and behind where we're standing there are various caverns with different things going on, mostly music now at the end of the day, Elevate Festival. A lot of the conversations have finished, but we're going to continue on momentarily. What's your name and where are you from?
Hey, my name is Mihi. My actually given name is Michel Bauer. I'm from Vienna, mostly.
You said your name is Mihi, but your given name. How do you get on online? Because a lot of online places now want your real name.
I have no trouble giving my real name, simply because my name is very, very common in Austria. So if I Google for my real name, it gives me 10,000s of hits. So I have no problem giving my real name. So my real name would be Michel Bauer, yeah.
So you're embracing the anonymity aspect of a common name. What do you do for a living?
Right now, I earn my money by working for the Austrian Association of Internet Users called Vibe. So it's vibe.at. And they decided to take NetPolitics and the NetPolitical engagement they do and make it more professional and hire someone to do it. And I'm the lucky person they hired because it's one of my passions. One of my secret passions all over the years was freedom in the digital age. And right now I actually get paid for engaging for my passion and campaigning against things like data retention, terror laws, for open access to devices, etc., etc.
How much freedom is there in the digital age right now?
There is, depending on how you look at it, there is quite a bit, but it's getting taken away. And especially if you look at civil liberties in the digital sphere, they're getting reduced more and more and more and more. It used to be that the internet is this vast open thing where we can, free of government control, do and exchange thoughts as we like. But this is actually changing right now in Europe and all over the world, that it's getting more restricted. We have talks about limiting the amount, the kind of content you can access. We have talks about storing information when you email people online, and there is this huge directive against for data retention that actually says you have to store, every member state of the EU has to store, the internet providers have to store for of every email who sends whom emails. So this is actually starting to limit the amount of freedom we have in the digital sphere quite a bit. And as the digital sphere gets more and more integrated, and the internet gets more and more integrated in our lives, and actually for some of the people it's our life, this impedes directly on the rights of people and directly on the human rights.
So you're not necessarily making a differentiation like some of the people I have actually met in Graz while I've been here, between our internet lives and what these people I've bumped into are calling real lives. Are we really that intertwined now with internet use that it is just another facet of our normal everyday existence?
For me, In this case, I like to quote the founders of the Pirate Bay, when they were in front of the court, and the judge asked them, "When did you first meet in real life?" And one of the defendants, I don't know who of the guys, asked, "What do you mean?" And the judge said, "I mean, face by face." And he replied, "We don't call it in real life. We call it away from keyboard. The internet is our real lives." And we certainly have a generation of people growing up now who never lived in a world without this possibility of interconnecting. And for them, communication over technology is part of their real lives, and it's getting parts of their real lives. Talking to someone on the phone is as real as chatting to someone over the internet, and might be as real as talking to someone face to face. Of course, a lot of information is lost in the process, but we're sort of getting there to transmit this. If you look at Skype, I used to live in the US and my girlfriend used to live in Vienna, and we talked over Skype a lot, and you have a picture of the person, you have the voice, you already get a lot of information. Of course, it's different if you can just look at the person and hug the person in the right moment or punch them in the face, whatever you want. But we are getting to a way where geographic separation starts to matter less simply because we get a lot of information actually transferred properly. And for me, this relationship, although you could call it a virtual internet relationship, was a real one, right? My girlfriend wasn't less real simply because I didn't see her face-to-face and only talked to her on Skype.
The internet, relationship didn't end because she was out of the room as such. So I noticed the embracing of the freedom to communicate here in Graz, and I believe you've been involved in Vienna by installing mesh networks so that there is quite a lot of connectivity when you're out and about. How does this work?
I want to spend a minute to talk about the reason we're doing this. So for me, freedom in the digital age has four technical prerequisites. This is free software, free hardware, free content, and in the end, free infrastructure. And we are engaging very much in the part of free infrastructure. What I mean by free infrastructure is telecommunication infrastructure that is owned by the people using it. So no one can shut down your cell phone tower if you need it to organize a protest. And no one controls the network but you and the peers that are also engaged in this sort of communication. Now, to the point how this works is, it basically works, we have this children's game where you tell a word to the next kid, to the next kid, and you send in a long line and the word gets secretly passed on. That's basically how it works. So a message from one computer, or one, we call it node, which is basically a wireless access point. So a message from one computer hops to the next computer, hops to the next computer, hops to the next computer, until there's a way it finds out into the internet and goes out there. And what we do is we install very, very standard Wi-Fi hardware on rooftops. So the messages that need to go to the internet and come back from the internet just hop from roof to roof to roof to roof, and then suddenly find a way where they can get out.
How do you find places to host this hardware, and how do you find the money to fund it?
The places are easy to find. That's the people who want to participate. So we have right now in Vienna, we have around 200 people or 200 roofs participating, and it's roughly 160 people. So some people just set it up for their friends and say, hey, you have a nice house and you see over the whole city, can I build an antenna on your roof and give you free internet? And they say, okay, and then they just do it. So you find it by the people who want to participate in a project like this. So I have to say that we are not a free internet project. We are a free infrastructure project. The fact that you can access the internet through our network is actually a nice byproduct and motivation to some, but it's not the key motivation of doing it. But still, you find the roofs by having people joining in and liking the idea. And the same way you fund it. So all the devices on the roofs are owned by the people who own the roof or who run the node. So they own their own hardware. The only thing we own as a sort of association is very, very core infrastructure, like the border router to the internet, where we tell the internet, hey, we have this network and come to us if you want it. And some servers to distribute addresses and to organize the community around it.
And you don't have any objections or problems with local councils and the government as such for giving all this free communication?
We don't. And this is a nice thing. And actually, most of the time, we don't even get no objections. We get very, very positive responses. The only time we had conflict with the authorities was in the very, very beginning when we started to grow. And we used antennas that were way over the legal limits. And someone complained about our network, just sort of disturbing his network, which wasn't true in the end. But he complained about it. And they had to, so we have an office for radio communication, and they had to come and they had to look at it. And they basically told us, listen, if you really use these antennas, there's no way you are going to stay in the legal limits. So better switch to different antennas. You're not supposed to do this. But we really love what you're doing.
Okay. Well, that's good. There's some definitely some forward-thinking people. So how important is this? How important is what you're doing? And how easy would it be to spread this to other towns and cities? Is it spreading?
It is spreading. So at the time we started with it, there was a wave of community wireless networks being set up all over Europe, all over the world. And this gave us tremendous energy, basically because also everyone was facing the same challenges and trying to solve the same problems. So we sort of served on a wave of excitement at that time. And the wave of excitement sort of died down after either the networks got established or didn't succeed. And then something very, very troubling to most of our internet, to most of us internet affine people, happened in January this year. This is the Egyptian government shutting off the internet. This is where we realized how important it is to control infrastructure. And it's important if you live in a society that is not as stable as ours today, but our societies can change. But it's also important if you want to set up infrastructure very, very quick. One of the advantages of this is we can set up cheap networking infrastructure very, very quick over a wide range and over a wide area. And there are projects actually doing this in developing countries. So there are projects trying to establish mesh networks in developing countries. And one of an older project is a project in Nepal, and they're actually working with Tibetan refugees and giving them the possibility to communicate with home through a wireless mesh network. So there are a lot of applications for this. If you need cheap and fast communication infrastructure that cannot be controlled by anyone.
So that's the answer to stop people from turning off the internet, as such, you would say, by creating wireless meshed infrastructures within areas that are at risk. But they would surely have to reach outside of that area to hit the ground and that reach the rest of the world.
This is a very good point, yes. And this is something I hope we can achieve in the future. Right now, in the network in Vienna, I'm very involved in. We are 20 kilometers off the border to Slovakia. We're 20 kilometers off Bratislava. And what I really hope to establish in this year or in the coming year is our first international link, so we can sort of internationally link and to other networks. I know that people with Funkfire in Graz, they're already linked experimentally to Slovenia. So, and we know of mesh networks that are growing in Luxembourg and Belgium and sort of growing together. So we stop having this highly localized urban networks and start having more spread international networks. And I really hope that at one point we can connect a large number of these networks together and sort of form an alternative structure that's across the internet. One interesting thing that is happening right now in the Austrian amateur radio community is that they built actually a wireless LAN network covering all Austria. They're only allowed to use it for their amateur radio purposes right now.
So they're not allowed to talk about politics. They're not allowed to talk about religion. They're not allowed to encrypt anything.
Exactly. But I don't know actually about the encryption fact. I talked to a couple of people and asked, how do you administer your boxes if you're not allowed to SSH in? Do you still use Telnet? And they looked at me and we don't like to talk about this. So basically, what the laws also state in the case of emergency, when if human lives are involved, and I would say toppling a regime is a case of emergency, and if you have a full-blown large protest or the government shuts down the internet, there's no one from keeping controlling you what you send over this network. So it's great to have this infrastructure as a sort of backbone infrastructure. And we have people that are active in both our community and the ham radio community. So it's a case of misconfiguration to link the two networks together.
So you're effectively guaranteeing in a way that the internet can't be turned off, which I guess is a step closer to ensuring that we have this kind of communication as a human right, although it's not, I guess, our decision to put it down in the Declaration of Human Rights.
Actually, it is already declared a human right. It already is declared a basic human right by the UN.
That you should have an internet connection.
Yes, it is.
I didn't know this. I knew that some countries had adopted it as a human right.
But. So the UN set down some. At some point earlier this year, and they issued this declaration that they consider connection to the internet or information networks as a basic human right.
So this access that they are saying is a human right could be attainable from your local library as such. If you can get to a library, we're not talking about in your pocket or in your household as yet.
No. It's access to information networks. However, how far you have to walk, they don't specify here.
Egypt turning that off was a crime against the UN's convention.
Yes, but it's not.
It happened afterwards.
I think it happened shortly afterwards, and even if the UN declaration would have been before Egypt, it would not have been the worst. Offense against human rights Egypt has conducted. So I wouldn't sort of worry about this and say, okay, Egyptians are bad because they they were bad because they were in sort of totalitarian regime having there, although they sort of elect their military president.
So we need to ensure that this is enforced then, and then maybe we can start having decent quality internet connections. I don't know what's your idea of a decent quality internet connection. I understand one that can't be turned off. That's now a dream of us all. But what kind of bandwidth do you think is reasonable?
My point on taking in this was I don't care how fast a message gets across. I care that the message gets across. So. Of course, with Wi-Fi, you have sort of a broadband internet connection. But my basic idea was always, I don't care how fast it is. I care that the message does get across. And that's the important thing. And one of the things I want to put there as a sort of cautionary note, and I think that's very important, is that we are in no illusion that the revolutions in the Arab Spring and the previous demonstrations in Iran against the regime were sort of mediated by the internet. They're actually done by people who are there. People in Iran protesting didn't have a clue about what Twitter is. Mm. Most of them didn't have an internet connection. Most had a cell phone, if at all. The internet is mainly a tool to communicate this news out. So the importance of the internet in Egypt for the revolution was not that people organized, because people did organize in the days we had no connection to Egypt and Egypt had no connection to the world. The only difference it made is the news didn't come to us. And the news coming to us is a very important point where we can sort of put pressure on our governments and our regimes not to support an evil guy anymore. And the problem in Syria I see right now is that they are so successful in oppressing communication to the outside that we barely have any news of what is going on in Syria. And people are actually killed nearly every day in demonstrations against the government in Syria.
Because there are no witnesses.
And there are witnesses, but they can't talk to us.
They can't tell us. The international witnesses are the ones that are going to be able to put pressure on, because we have the louder voice. We have the internet in order to put pressure on. As much as we would like to sit down and write letters, sometimes it is just easier.
Of course, it is easier. And it's sometimes also this more. So I think governments and especially companies get more and more aware of their reputation on social networks. So a person I work very closely with asked for their passenger name records of the Austrian Airlines a couple of months back, and they didn't reply to him in the time they had to reply to him based on the law. And what he did was not to complain at some sort of commission. He simply tweeted, "Hey, I send this company a request about my information, and I didn't get anything in the 8 weeks they had time to respond to me." And on the same day, a couple of hours later, he got an email by the airline saying, "Hey, sorry, we sort of missed this one, and we will be in contact with you shortly." So the PR departments of both the parties and companies closely mirror or watch the communication that's going on. And if there's anything that could harm their reputation, they will respond to it. So it's a good tool to make pressure because they have the impression that it can do so much. And their reputation is based upon you knowing that they are a nice company. But if everyone on Twitter tweets they actually suck and they treat your data in a very bad way, which they do, no one would be a customer with them anymore. Mm. So I think this is a way to really make political and social pressure on either politicians or governments or companies to do some sort of changes. And this is what we need the internet communication for. If somewhere there's a crisis where there are riots and there is huge violation of human rights, such as the right to assembly and the right to express your own opinion.
So let's keep the internet free as best we can, and thank you for doing what you can to do that.
You're welcome. It's a passion of mine, and I will continue doing it, and I hope more people join in, and I hope more people provide different projects.
What can people Google to find out more if they do want to do this?
Our project is called Funkfeuer. It's FunkFeuer. And it's very, very closely related to what Freifunk does in Germany. That's FreiFunk. But generally, you can read upon community wireless networks and mesh networks or community mesh networks. And one of the interesting aspects of this is if you Google for mesh networks, you will find a lot of military documentation. So the military was examining this technology very, very heavily a couple of years back, and actually now we're using it against
really interesting mobile-worn radios that each soldier uses. So they are a mobile mesh themselves, with one guy being the uplink. It's really interesting. Thanks. Loads of information. The longest recording I think I've done at the Elevate Festival, just because I was fascinated. Let's go and get a beer. Thank you.
Thank you.